Welcome to the Fuller Chasey Money Audio Commentary. This is David Fuller on Friday, the 18th of September, and I'm recording at 10:37 p.m., and that is still British summertime here in London. Okay, this being Friday, this is the big picture long-term outlook for the various asset classes, but first, let's just talk about what's going on here in the short term for a few minutes, including the Fed's decision, which is an important item. Tying in with that, what you might have already seen, but I'll review it anyway, is that the Fed's decision to leave rates on hold will have reassured investors in a number of the emerging markets, particularly in the Asian emerging markets. And the main reason for that, and a concern of mine, and not just me, obviously, is that those countries had done a lot of borrowing in U.S. dollars when the U.S. dollar was lower. You go back a year or so ago. And so dollar strength was a concern. And if we had had the U.S. going ahead with an interest rate hike and another one planned for later this year, as a lot of people were expecting, then that would have caused some possible problems. And then you've also got the fact that you're still getting plenty of QE coming from Japan and also within Europe. And the last thing the Fed wants is for the dollar to spike higher. I mean, it's not impossible that that could happen anyway, although the Fed would try to prevent it. But the important point I was making first, getting off the ground with this discussion, is that those Asian markets were a little bit relieved that the Fed, definitely relieved that the Fed passed on an interest rate hike. Now, they may have more trouble on Monday, given what happens later, but this is a choppy period in markets, and we've got a nervous environment. So more on that in a minute, but let's see what else. What actually did happen in the Asia-Pacific region today. Japan was down, and fairly sharply, the yen strengthened, following the news that we were not going to get a rate hike by the U.S. dollar weakened. So Japan was down a couple of points, percentage points, I should say. But China was a little bit higher right across the board. Nothing big, but nevertheless steady in here. India had a decent day, up about 1% on average. Most of these other Asia-Pacific markets were a little higher. Two exceptions that were weaker were, Singapore and also Malaysia. Now, certainly more drama in the European markets. These were hit hard, and I haven't seen too much news on this. I mean, there are a lot of concerns because of all the immigration problems they're actually having. You're seeing thousands and thousands of people pouring over the borders, and this is a real crisis. And it's been building for a while, but it seems to have no end, and I think that helped to unnerve these markets in here today. So we had some big hits. Germany down just over 3%. Same on the Euro Stoxx 50 index. Those were the biggest declines. But France down over 2.5%. Same with Spain. Same with Italy. So big hits right across the boards in all the European markets. Smallest ones were the UK, but it was still down 1.33%, and Switzerland down 1.25%. Then on Wall Street. Now Wall Street was short-term overbought. And if you look at the stochastics indicator in the chart library for the indices, you will see that. And we'd also we'd had pretty good rallies, which had created the short-term overbought condition, and we had the NASDAQ indices right up on their high, up over their MAs, and testing the or not within reach of their peaks. And they got clipped yesterday, fell back sharply, and they fell back sharply, even more sharply, in here today. So we had the Dow down 1.75%, the S&P slightly less, 1.6%, and the NASDAQ down 1 1/3 position, percentage points. And that led to weakness in Canada and Mexico and Brazil. Brazil down 2.65%. 5%. Some of those commodities were hit hard in here. So nervous environment. Let me go back to the Fed overall, and in the context of what we know is a seasonal period of underperformance. That's the May through the end of October period, and the big event, which had occurred for the U.S. For the first time in 4 years, was a 10% plus stock market correction. It was something that I was forecasting before going away on my holiday back in August, that we would almost certainly see that before the end of October. Well, we have, and it happened fairly quickly. And most of it came with that explosive downside move, climactic downside move is the way I should describe it, on the 24th of August. But a move of that magnitude unnerves people. We've seen that before. We've all seen it before. And people say, "Well, what's going wrong? What's happened here?" And they come up with all list, start listing all the things that are a concern. Now, there are some real concerns. We wouldn't be getting corrections. Wall Street's valuations were a little high prior to that correction, and they're still a little high in some instances. We also had the China situation, which, in terms of their market mismanagement, I should describe it, a poor regulation of their market, allowing a big bubble to develop in the mainland indices on the way up, and then trying to rein it in and being a bit heavy-handed with all that. And you know the story. And so that was unnerving people. Then we have the slow global GDP growth, and people are wondering when that's actually going to pick up. So that's another concern here overall. And what the Fed, in considering its policies, and a lot of people were thinking that the Fed would be happy to n nudge rates up a quarter of a point, and then maybe again in December. But the closer we got to this meeting, which occurred this week, occurred yesterday, the decision, clearly there was no compelling case. There were a lot of people who said, "Oh, just get it underway." They were impatient. They didn't like seeing this come back and frustrate them, or they didn't want to be preoccupied with will they, won't they, will they, won't they. But that's not a good reason for the Fed to actually make a move. So why should the Fed make a move? First, do you have an inflation problem in the U.S.? Well, clearly not. And that's partly with the help of technology, which certainly keeps that helps to keep that inflation down. And the accelerated rate of technological innovation. Too many people don't realize that. By the way, but the technology creates some positive disinflation, and that winds up in the statistics as well. And then we have the oil prices, which are much, much lower, so that certainly helped a lot on the inflation. So did the excuse me, stronger dollar. That we've seen over the last 6 to 9 months, that had helped to keep the inflation out, and softness of commodity markets generally. Another factor there. So if the Fed has a 2% inflation target, which it does, and inflation is hovering near zero, why do you need to raise rates? And also, in terms of the U.S. economy, it's seen a modest, choppy recovery that's been unfolding. Is it overheating? Well, obviously not. It's not a strong economic recovery by any means. And therefore, again, why does the Fed actually need to go ahead and start raising rates? I'm sure that's what the Fed was saying to itself or asking of itself. And so they left them on hold. I thought it was a wise decision. So did some of the people in the in developing economies, as I mentioned at the very beginning. But inevitably, when you've had a choppy market period and corrections, and then people are a little bit spooked, and they even a bit paranoid, and they're looking for trouble, and there's always somebody to offer some. Markets are very emotional, as we know, and therefore you're getting a number of people who've been saying, well, maybe the Fed saw something that the rest of us haven't seen. Now, that's it was a predictable predictable comment. It's almost a primal anxiety. This is not highly analytical here. And these Fed academics, well, if you're paying attention to the data that the Fed's looking at, and I've covered some of it here, and that inflation's flat. Also, a point that I hadn't mentioned is that while employment figures have improved, or I'll put it this way, unemployment figures have come down, nevertheless, there is concern over the quality of the jobs that are actually being created. That's partly related to technology. And there are a lot of people who are working on a part-time basis who would prefer to work on a full-time basis here overall. So at 5.1%, while that's not bad in terms of the total unemployment figure, Europe would love to have, continental Europe would love to have that. The Fed was a little bit concerned about it, and not least because one of the strongest factors in the improvement in U.S. employment data had come from in earlier quarters had come from the fracking industry, the whole U.S. energy industry, but particularly from fracking, and they were getting a lot of layoffs there right now. So again, there was no compelling reason for the Fed to raise those rates, although a lot of people wanted the Fed to actually do that. And probably the Fed, after all the harangue going on about this, they'd be relieved to get a few rate increases on the books. But the key point here is that you don't want to err on the side of raising rates too quickly. And then you cause damage to the economy, and then you have to rush in and undo it, and that undermines confidence a little bit further. So the Fed clearly is deciding we don't, there's nothing, no compelling reason why we need to raise rates right now. And with the inflation data is low enough, so we can err on the side of caution. That's what they've done, err on the side of caution. And I think it was a sensible move here overall. But Wall Street, as you know, got into this. Well, what does the Fed know that we don't know? Well, my answer to that is nothing. If you've been paying attention, and as I know you have for the most part. So, again, markets still nervous in this environment. That's going to be with us for a while. Now, what about the China situation? Well, it's well known, but is this a disaster case? I don't think so. Here over overall. China's probably still growing at around 4% or slightly below that level. That's not too bad here for sure. India is growing at a faster rate than that overall. Europe is gradually improving and still getting plenty of QE. So in terms of the overall background, we're going to have monetary accommodation. We still have monetary accommodation from the U.S. They ended their QE, of course, but they certainly aren't selling any bonds, and they are keeping those very, very low interest rates here that we see, and so that's a stimulative background here overall. Now, moving forward from that, and bringing in some of the other participants, you've got the Japan I mentioned. China has its own QE program underway, as do some of the other Asian economies. The European Central Bank is definitely going to keep its accommodative easing. So you weigh it all up in terms of monetary policy. It's accommodative, and tight monetary policies. That's the last thing we have here right now. In other words, we certainly don't have it. But it's tightening monetary policy that really causes more bear markets than any other factor, and we're nowhere near that tight monetary policy environment. So, what about the global GDP growth? My guess is that it will just gradually improve in an erratic fashion going forward. So here we are. Wall Street gets the correction. We get a global stock market correction. What's the net consequence of that overall? Well, the good news is that it has lowered valuations. And higher valuations were a bit of a concern. So it's shaken out a lot of leveraged positions overall. Valuations have improved somewhat as a consequence. And I think that's good for investors who have some cash that they'd like to invest and pick up. I would focus on big companies. I would focus on companies with decent yields, and there are certainly plenty of those around. Where did we have some bubble characteristics? Well, tech was a little bit bubbly, or some portions of tech were a little bit bubbly, and we've seen some decent corrections in those sectors. So I weigh it all up, and I say that well, good. What's taken place in the markets has actually both improved valuations, thrown some of the froth out of the market. China's A shares no longer in bubble territory. Mainland China shares, neither A nor B shares in bubble territory. You have a number of quite steep valuation. I beg your pardon. You have a number of depressed valuations around the globe, and not least in staying with China, not least in Hong Kong. Those H shares and the other main Hang Seng index there. Additional problems? Well, the commodity producers are certainly suffering, and that's something that isn't going to change here overnight. But in terms of the global economy, those weak commodity prices do lower inflationary pressures, and that's good for all the economies that need to buy commodities. So we don't have heating up food prices. Food prices are mostly quite low. The one exception is rice, which is no longer low, but it's certainly not all that high. We have very low prices for the industrial metals. That creates some concern for the for the miners, but we're beginning to get a little bit of cutback in supply, and then one of the reasons why those metal prices are so low, it's all to do with supply. Companies were a little too optimistic about what China would be buying, and that happens in cycles. But also the technological advantages that the miners have, at least the big miners have, they can produce much more cheaply and much more effectively. So big miners like BHP and Rio Tinto can ride this out and gain market share and probably maintain their dividends as long as this doesn't go on for indefinitely at these prices. So it's not a bad environment here overall. Wrap it up, stimulative monetary conditions, very low inflationary pressures. I think we'll have more to worry about when we do see clear evidence that inflation is moving up towards the 2% level in the US and other economies, and that's well down the road. I'll put it that way. That's not yet on the on the horizon. And in terms of the longer term picture, we're going to have a choppy environment. We should expect that to continue here overall. But I think that today, with these stock markets, the valuations suit the bulls more than the bears. And I'll just repeat that key point. I would stick with big companies and companies that have decent yields. On a much longer term basis, I think that before the end of this decade, we will see somewhat stronger growth that'll lead to turbulence, as I've already mentioned, and somewhat higher interest rates. But we will that they will it will also help to improve corporate earnings. It will bury some of the current concerns about low growth forever and deflationary pressures here overall. And I think that we will see clear evidence of renewed bull markets well before the end of the end of the decade. But we're in this choppy environment here right now. So buy low and sell high within that environment. And it's not always easy to do. I put myself in that category as well. It's much easier for me to buy low than to sell high. But I know no further digression on that. What about government bonds here? Well, I think key off the U.S. Treasuries first. That's the most important bond market to watch. The charts suggest to us that this is a very long-term base-building process. I've thought all along that it would be a long-term base-building process for yields, and that they will range sideways in a choppy fashion. Big Type 3 base, if you've taken the if you've attended the chart seminar, and that as global GDP growth does gradually pick up, and that may be a couple of years down the road. Then we'll see those yields push higher overall. So they may bonds. Well, the bonds are still serving as a safe haven here during a volatile stock market swings, but the long-term outlook for the bond market is basically of somewhat higher yields. I don't think we're going to get huge moves up in yields, but definitely somewhat higher yields overall, and I don't think that's all that attractive an investment category. But will bonds be reasonably safe for the lengthy medium term, at least a few more months, and probably is the answer. It's a base building for process with a long fuse here overall. Now, what would cause those bond yields to move higher? Well, it's got to be stronger global GDP growth across the boards, and that's not a short-term prospect, but it is a long-term prospect. And I view bonds in a historic perspective. You had this spectacular bull market, falling yields for 35 years, and that's over. That yields will be ranging sideways to higher over the next decade or so. Okay, looking at currencies, the dollar is the one in the pole position here right now. U.S. economy is on a relative basis is a little bit more reassuring than most other economies. You don't have too much in the way of major problems there for the U.S. I think the election will be important. I mean, my own view is that you need some sensible Republican economic policies, and provided they are sensible. But I don't think we're going to get a Republican president elected, because just to get nominated, they have to make too many statements that I think are a big on, not least on social issues, which are a big turnoff for the majority of the electorate there. Does it boil down to what I thought would be the case all along between Bush and Hillary Clinton? That wouldn't surprise me. Politics can certainly have a big unpredictable element, but it wouldn't surprise me too much. And I suspect that Clinton would win that runoff. And I also feel that the two Clintons working together know a fair amount. Well, Bill Clinton certainly knows a fair amount about economic policy and what's required for GDP growth, and that's not going to be too bad down the road. Give the Obama administration credit for his achievements on social issues and on their own form of a national health service, although they obviously don't call it that. I give him credit for something the Republicans are all fussing about, which is removing the sanctions on Iraq. And I think that he, in my opinion, he deserves credit for those issues. But in the economy, I don't. As far as the economy is concerned, I don't think that this administration has done much to help the U.S. economy overall, and it needs a little bit better economic governance, a little bit more interest in that, and focus on that. To help the U.S. economy, and I suspect we will probably have that after the U.S. election. But I see the U.S. as being in a reasonably strong position on a global basis, and that will underpin the U.S. dollar. The USA's capabilities in the oil sector now, with the development of its fracking technologies, and that's going to be a major factor keeping down U.S. energy costs for a very, very long time. And I've Owen and I maintain that that whole fracking procedure is far more promising, far more profitable, and there's a vast amount of oil in those in those sites, and we're already seeing that. And yes, new frack is completely different technology, so that once you've drilled and are drawing oil out of a fracking site, that the yield tends to drop off fairly quickly. But lo and behold, almost like a cornucopia, you leave it alone for a year or so, and you can go back in with refracking because it gradually fills it back up again. And it's a technical point, and the technology's improving all the time. But my strong forecast is that the U.S. will be largely energy self-sufficient for really a very long time. And that's another factor here that can help to underpin the U.S. dollar here overall. And the dollar had a long secular bear market prior to last year, when it is bottoming out and beginning to move upwards. And I think that we'll get a long and hopefully gradual secular bull market. I say hopefully gradual because we don't want to see the dollar moving up too rapidly. That would cause all sorts of problems, and obviously not just for the USA. Commodities overall, the low prices that we've seen in the energy sector are a real crisis for the countries that are primarily energy suppliers. That's been the case for, well, we've known that for a number of months now, and I don't see that actually changing. I do not think that we're going to see that $20 forecast for crude oil realized. I think that, down in the low 40 region, upper 30s, possibly. That's probably the extent of the downside. You start to get very rapid reduction in production, I think, below those levels. What might it eventually do on the upside? Well, that would be partly a political decision. I think that the OPEC strategy is not working here overall. At some point, I would assume that they're going to declare victory and start cutting back on supply. It's supply that's the problem. Demand is holding up, we're going to we certainly haven't seen any big cutbacks here so far, and they did not realize how the U.S. would continue to produce that shale oil despite the big drop in the in prices. So I think that we're closer to the lower side of the range. Will we get back to the $80 that OPEC is forecasting in a couple of years' time? I doubt it. Or if you do, I think it would be a now you see it and now you don't. And this is a permanent change here, and because of the ability to produce far more oil when people were mistakenly saying that the world was running out of oil only 10 to 15 years ago. That's clearly not the case with all the fracking potential that exists around the globe. And also, again, technology is helping to further develop known conventional oil sites that will help to keep it the prices lower. Then the very rapid development of the solar industry, and that's something that'll still be developing over the next 50 years, and beyond, no doubt. So, and there are other renewable sources. So One of my forecasts is that we would see cheaper oil, cheaper energy costs over the long term. And really, what we're doing is we're getting closer to leaving behind the extremely expensive energy costs. And I think sort of at the end of this decade, we'll be in a better position still. And that's another 5 years nearly. Go 15 years down the road, I think we'll see an even better environment in terms of energy production and favorable costs. So that's a good that's a good story in terms of global GDP growth. That will be good for stock markets as well. But right now, here today, it creates it's creating problems within the oil industry, and particularly in terms of the producers of oil. What about agricultural commodities? That's a weather play more than anything else. But I think that here also technology does help to improve production capabilities. But do we have a real chance of losing a lot of California's agricultural produce over the next 10 or 20 years? It's certainly at risk, I'll put it that way. And that's a huge challenge for technology, which I wrote about earlier in the week. China faces a similar situation, but there are plenty of other regions in the world where we're getting very good crop yields, and they're actually improving, and that's likely to increase with the help of technology. So I don't see any massive food problems going forward. And the energy picture, as I've already indicated, I think is really quite attractive. And we could say the same for costs and the supplies of industrial, in addition to oil, other industrial commodities as well. Not a bad outlook here overall at a time when people are, well, some people at any rate, a fair number of people, are quaking about what's going on in the global economy and in stock markets. Buy when there's real fear in the air. And on that note, all the very best to all of you. And if you're a rugby fan, well, you'll be able to watch some wonderful games over the next 6 weeks. On that note, all the very best to all of you.